Disc 5.
Julie chokes. As food? She asks around a mouthful of sandwich. Oh, yeah, sorry. No, not as food. The vampire analogy has a few bugs in it. I forgot about the blood-sucking thing. I think that's a pretty big part of it. So how do vampires see people? As partial. Half alive, half awake. Potentially awake, but not. Like zombies? I don't know. That seems like too much. On the other hand, I look back on my own life before enlightenment, and zombie doesn't seem too bad. Like I was sleepwalking, or like I was alive, but
I wasn't there.
That sounds backwards, but that's what it's like. Let's use lucid dreaming again. If you woke up inside a dream, how would you see the other people in the dream? How seriously would you take things? She's chewing very slowly. I think she's paying attention. I return to the stage analogy. Imagine you're in the audience watching a play, and you slowly come to realize that the actors don't know they're actors. They think that they're normal people going about their normal lives, unaware that they're on a stage, performing. You could never even believe such a thing would be possible if you yourself hadn't been up there yourself believing the same thing. That would be pretty weird, she agrees. So you're sitting here with me right now, and we're both up on the stage, and from your perspective, it's like being with a... Oh. That's why you seemed uncomfortable when you heard the question. You didn't want to call me a zombie. That's so sweet. I give her my aw shucks, ma'am, grin. I don't know. Maybe. I don't mind answering any question as honestly and accurately as I can. That's my thing. But it's just not always possible. Just saying that I view people as half asleep, or, as the Tao says, as straw dogs, doesn't come close to addressing the larger question of who I am and what the stage is and what the other players are doing. So, yeah, to me, unawake people are sort of not really present. But if you think about it, this is the place for that. What on earth is the point of being enlightened on earth? If anything is a little goofy, it's sitting in the audience of a dramatic event that is performed solely for the amusement of the performers. Really, if anyone at this table could be reckoned in any sense lesser, it would be me, because I'm the one who walked off the stage in a huff saying, I didn't want to play anymore. Damn, she says. Well, that's really just the beginning. The difference between us isn't that I'm enlightened and you're not. The difference between us is that I know it and you don't. I possess selfless awareness and you don't. I know that's starting to sound like guru speak, but it's the simple truth. The truth is identical for both of us. I haven't achieved a better status than you. When you hear someone say that searching for enlightenment is like fish in the ocean struggling to find water, this is what they mean. One fish may know it, and the other may not, but they're both swimming in an ocean of water, and always were. We eat in silence for a while. I haven't done this much talking at a stretch in recent memory, and I'm getting tired of hearing my own barbaric yawp. When we're done eating, we clean up our mess and stroll up the hill away from town to a small park. I'm thinking about this theater of yours, she says, leaving it hanging. Yeah? It's not like your higher self you're talking about, right? You're not saying... I understand. No. It has nothing to do with the hierarchy of souls, or the different planes of consciousness, or higher and lower self and all that. From the seat in the audience I'm describing, everybody is on stage, whether they're in a body or not in a body, on the physical plane or the astral plane or the Buddhic plane, whatever. Those are just the broader dimensions of the same dramatic event. So if I just became instantly enlightened right now, just out of the blue, which, despite countless claims to the contrary, can't happen, but go ahead. Well, a lot of people say it does. A lot of people say a lot of things, and I'm sure they believe it. But you don't? I don't operate at the level of belief. I might guess that there are never more than 50 truth-realized beings on Earth at any moment, and I might suspect that most of them have the sense to keep their mouths shut about it. But what I know is that none of them became truth-realized except through a slow and agonizing process of self-annihilation. What about all the teachers and gurus that say, when someone says they became enlightened in an instant, they're probably talking about the transformation brought on by a transcendental experience, an experience of mystic union or some variation of it. It's powerful and can be massively transformative, but it's not enlightenment. Enlightenment isn't flashy, and it doesn't just occur like an epiphany. What about students of Zen? You always hear these stories. Yeah, I think of Jolene. The BAM factor. There's no such thing as instant enlightenment any more than there's such a thing as an instant baby. Storks don't really deliver babies, and there's no enlightenment fairy hovering over Zen monasteries or anywhere else. It's easy to see how the idea would catch on, but there's only one way a caterpillar becomes a butterfly. No depth of insight into what it's like to be a vampire can ever make you a vampire. In terms of Plato's cave, those who have stared into the fire that illuminates the cave will naturally believe that they've arrived at the source. But the fire is a mere spark of the sun that illuminates all, including the mountain that houses the cave. "Damn," she says, and then takes on a sly look. "Has it ever occurred to you that you might be, what's a good way to say it? Mentally, nuts?" I laugh. "Insane? It's about time somebody asked." "Well, let's think about it. I basically believe that I know everything and nobody else knows anything. I think I'm sane and everyone else is insane. I've never met another like me, and I have to search through centuries and civilizations to find anyone similar. The greatest men and women who have ever lived are just children on a playground to me. I think that I know the mind of God, that the universe does my bidding, and that all of creation exists for my amusement. By what possible definition of the word am I not insane?" She just stares at me. "So," I ask, "what was your question before I interrupted?" She continues to stare. "I totally forget." I just laugh. Chapter 20. Right here, right now. All forces have been steadily employed to complete and delight me. Now, on this spot, I stand with my robust soul. Walt Whitman. I roll into the driveway around 5 o'clock. It's not lost on me that Sonea engineered my absence, and I assume I'll now find out why. I'm not disappointed. The cement truck is my first clue. I park the car wondering if I might have a swimming pool or a tennis court in my future. If so, they're putting it in the wrong place. The focus of activity seems to be in just beyond the smaller of two wooded areas, just over a small knoll. I walk out that way. There are 8 or 9 workers preparing for a pour. The surveyors and the backhoe have obviously come and gone. The forms have been set, and the cement mixer I saw is not the first of the day. They're pouring into deep trenches that go below the frost line. The general shape is rectangular, and it's clear they are pouring the footing for walls as well as a large L-shaped slab floor along 2 of the walls. The building that I am now learning of has been cut into the knoll so that the earth and trees will shield it on the northwest side, which is where our most treacherous winter weather blows in from. The footings extend into a rectangle that is much larger than the slab floor they're creating, and I know that it's because, in addition to the building, there will be a low-walled courtyard. I know the building will actually be four sets of bedrooms large enough for four people each, and that a pair of common bathrooms and a large central living space with a fireplace will serve them all. I also know that the courtyard will have a large patio and a central fire pit for cooking and bonfires. The building and walls will be built using straw bale construction and rammed earth techniques. The whole thing will have a sun-bleached adobe look. I know all this because Sonea and I discussed this particular design for bunkhouses around 5 years ago. Wow. What the hell else have I said? I think I once said that I'd like an airstrip so we could get a plane and skydive here. I better find Sonea and cancel that one very specifically. Or not. I can see where they've ditch-witched trenches for water and power, and I can see that they have planned for sewage. We're in an unincorporated part of the county, and nothing about this entire project will be subject to any governmental scrutiny except the sewer. I know that our county sewer inspector is a real terror, but I'm sure that after a few minutes with Sonea, he'll be asking for a shovel and working on it himself to make it right. She has that effect on people. I plop down on top of the knoll and watch the work. They're trying to get all the concrete poured tonight. I see now that they've brought in a drain pipe and a load of gravel and created a temporary entrance from the road at the northeast of the property so they wouldn't have to tear the place up too much. At least, I assume it's temporary. I get bored watching, so I go down and help with the forms and shoveling gravel and whatever else needs doing. We continue until around 9 o'clock, when the final concrete is poured and groomed. The sun is down, the concrete is all poured, and a dozen students are sitting on top of the knoll eating and chatting and watching. They give me a round of applause as I approach. They've probably never seen me do any actual work before. Greetings all around. Light joking. Rita hands me a plastic container and some chopsticks, and I find some matar puleo and a piece of puree still hot and flaky. I start eating, and the gang starts presenting me with questions that arose in their discussions while I toiled. They burst into a flurry of activity, and I sit down to eat. It's a cool evening, almost chilly, so the fire will be nice. Word gets back to me that Sonea has a puja ceremony scheduled for the new building and that we should proceed without her. It starts drizzling, which is actually very pleasant. Jed? Yes. I reply around a mouthful of bread and rice and cheese. I turn and I see that it's Sarah. The last time I spoke with her, we agreed that she'd try to see beyond the generally accepted views about the benefits of her spiritual beliefs and practices and return to me when she had some fresh insights to share. After a few moments, she hasn't spoken, so I look and see that she's fighting back tears. Oh, no, honey, what's the matter? Here, come on, sit down. I am not in the least bit immune to the tears of pretty young ladies. She sits on the grass next to me, and I wrap an arm around her. She nestles in and releases some pent-up tears. I couldn't do what you said. I tried. I thought about it a lot. I laugh and rock her playfully. Is that all? You had me worried. I thought something was wrong. You know what it means when you get stuck on something like that? She looks up at me, teary and childlike. What? It means you should come to me and ask. If people don't come to me and ask questions, well, I'm out of a job. You don't want to put me out of a job, do you? She laughs. What did I tell you? I said. No worries, Mon. Didn't I say that? She nods. And here you are, all worried about a silly question. Here's what we'll do. Are you going to hang around for the fire and to hear the old wise fool drone on tonight? Yes, she says. Okay. Just relax and enjoy the evening and come talk to me afterward, and we'll see how you feel, okay? Okay. Good. Now buzz off. They catch me with my arm around a pretty young girl like you. They'll accuse me of impropriety, and I'll have to become a wandering ascetic. You know what that means?
What?
Homeless. Living in dumpsters. Washing my armpits in gas station sinks. Fighting rats for scraps.
That's terrible. Okay, I'll go.
Come see me afterwards, I remind her. She gets up and goes to help with the setup. I continue eating my meal in the drizzle, as a fire pit is dug and ringed with stones and filled with logs, and then surrounded by lawn chairs and makeshift benches. The seating is not evenly distributed. It's mostly on one side, with only one seat, the most comfortable, all by itself facing the rest. I watch in amusement and amazement, and the Grateful Dead line runs through my mind, as it often does. What a long, strange trip it's been. How did I end up here? How did such a simple thing as a yearning for truth evolve into this? And, more interestingly, where is this evolution going? Here? To this? To this house? To these people? I watch them as they prepare the fire for our evening together. Is this it? Is this what it was all for? Is this teaching thing I do what it's all been moving toward? The answer, I know, is no. Close, but not quite there yet. The picture is not yet complete. Even now, the larger pattern of my life is only beginning to reveal itself. To explain this, I have to say something about the way my mind works, the way I view and move through life. Simply put, I don't think. I don't make choices or decisions. I don't weigh possibilities and select one over others. Instead, I observe patterns and move with them. I have a refined sense of rightness and not rightness that guides me in all things. No decision in my life is made through ratiocination. I wait for unfolding. I sense currents, and I flow with them. You don't have to be enlightened to operate this way. You just have to release the tiller. Once you do, an entirely new way of flowing through life opens to you, a way that is based on rightness and sensitive to not rightness. So, when I look at my own life, my own story, I look for the patterns, the unifying theme, the sum of the parts that explain my existence. It's not this. I know that much. It's not this house. It's not these people. This is all just another tile in the mosaic. The self-immolation of what I've since termed spiritual autolysis was a critical element, but not the defining one. The point of my existence is not enlightenment. Enlightenment, too, is just another piece. Who I am now, what I have become, is not the end result, just another piece of a larger picture. But what larger picture? What does it all add up to? What will the puzzle look like when complete? I sit on my now soggy butt eating my now soggy dinner, and I wonder what single outcome ties together all the seemingly unrelated twists and turns in my peculiar life. The answer to that question is only now coming into focus. The book. This book. It all makes sense in light of this book. This book is the big picture, the full expression of me, of my existence. The book is what it's all been about since day one and before. Hundreds of seemingly unrelated bits of my life that make little or no sense in any other context resolve into focus. The book is the thing. These people, my students, are all on their own journeys, but they are also playing a critical role in my creative journey, and this book is and has always been the true destination of that journey. Everything points to this. All indications confirm it. The pattern is clear. It's all been about this book. Idly, soggily, I wonder what comes after. Eventually, everything is ready, and the fire is roaring, and everyone is standing around waiting. I can see that a lot of anticipation has built up, a lot of energy. Everyone has worked themselves up into a expectant euphoria that I'm happy to plug into and take for a ride. I shuffle down from the knoll to my seat, but remain standing. They applaud my approach, and I applaud them right back. I begin by smiling my ass off. I can't help it. The whole thing just bubbles up inside me at times. "What a trip," I hear myself saying, and the energy increases faster than I can release it. What an utterly insane and magical ride we're on. Is this not the damnedest thing? Is it not? Everyone is nodding, responding to the energy, feeling it. I feel them, and they feel me, and we all feel this thing that we're sharing and creating together. "Check it out," I say. "I'm the enlightened guy, and you're all the guys who want to be enlightened guys, too. So we're all here in this beautiful place with the lovely rain and the beautiful fire. And what could possibly be better? What could be more cool? Am I really the teacher? I look at you guys, each one of you, and I see people I'd like to have for my own teachers. I see heart centering, and I'm in complete awe and admiration. I see courage and intelligence, and I wish I possessed it in similar measure. I see sincerity and strength and pulsing life force. I think of Sonaya inside, and my heart nearly bursts with gratitude. I make eye contact with each of them in turn, staying with each for a moment, acknowledging each, sharing. This is it. Not some other time, not some other place. Right here, right now. I am standing at the exact center of infinity, and I see perfection and beauty and absolute delight everywhere and in everything. The touch of the slightest breeze, the sight of a single star through cloud-swept skies, the howls of coyote pups in the distance, and the sheer glory and beauty of it all is enough to tear me to shreds. And all I can say is thank you. Thank you. Thank you. There is clapping and hooting and tears and hugging and hand-holding in the group. Not because of the words, but because that thing that was bubbling up has bubbled over and soaked us all. It's a surging wave of energy, and if the chairman of the PLO and the Prime Minister of Israel were sitting here right now, they'd be in each other's arms, weeping. And that's a fact, because this is the real deal, mystical shit, and no one is immune. "In other words," I yell, "I'm in a great fucking mood." This brings a renewed round of catcalls and applause and hooting. Everyone's up and making contact now, making noise. I pull a piece of folded paper out of my pocket and read it aloud. This is a poem by Rumi I've been carrying around. I clear my throat and begin. I said, "Oh no, help me." And that oh no became a rope let down in my well. I've climbed out to stand here in the sun. One moment I was at the bottom of a dank, fearful narrowness, and the next I am not contained by the universe. If every tip of every hair on me could speak, I still couldn't say my gratitude. In the middle of these streets and gardens, I stand and say again, it's all I say. I wish everyone could know what I know. I look at the faces, and they're all open, all joyous, all radiant. I pass the poem around. We let the moment ride.
I take my seat and watch the fire and smile at these wonderful people. When you start bursting with that whole mystical love gratitude thing, I tell them, Rumi's your guy.
Chapter 21 Pasupatastra. I am he. I am the sage. I am the superior man. I am the crown of creation. I am daft, clouded, obscure. I eat when hungry, sleep when tired. I move with, not across, not against. I rub my chin at the appointed hour. I see only patterns. I have no eye for detail. I don't go. Why go? Go where? It comes. I don't try. I don't do. Nothing goes undone. I don't take sides. I have no preferred outcome. It's all me. It's all mine. Otherless, what's to want? I have amazing powers. I get good tables in restaurants. I haven't stubbed a toe in 12 years. I can destroy the universe with a thought. Jed McKenna. Chapter 22 Truth Talk in the Dream State. In the knowledge of the Atman, which is the dark night to the ignorant, the recollected mind is fully awake and aware. The ignorant are awake in their sense life, which is darkness to the sage. Bhagavad Gita.
It's probably 20 minutes before everyone settles down. When they do, the talk gradually turns to matters that various members of the group have obviously been discussing amongst themselves. I am content to sit back, listen, and get a feel for the different personalities and how they interact with each other. Occasionally, I am called upon to hand down a ruling, but I keep it brief and generally bounce it back in the form of a question. It's all very light and easy. At one point, one of them, a pretty sincere guy named Brendan, asks me what the meaning of life is. But he tosses out the question in a casual way, suggesting that he considers it unanswerable. So I let it go. Jed, says one of the guys, Randy, when you say that there is nothing to know in order to be enlightened, yes? I just can't reconcile that with any of the world's great teachings and religions. I mean, what about yoga and Vedanta and Buddhism? What about Greek and German philosophers? What about Christianity and Islam and Judaism? How can there be nothing to know? Obviously, this is something he's really struggling with.
It's incomprehensible. It's just too much. I can't get a handle on it. There's a murmur of agreement. The question seems to resonate with all of them. I know what you mean, I reply. The only thing to get a handle on is negation, the tearing down process. I know you want to learn something, to embrace something, to understand. Humans are comprised of emotion and intellect, so it's only natural to want to follow one or both of these aspects of ourselves inward to the truth. But you can't. You could spend 1,000 years with your nose in books, or at the feet of masters and still be no closer to waking up from delusion. The fact is that no amount or combination of knowledge can bring about truth realization. Everyone is attentive now. This is something that has concerned them all. They are all seated and standing, a few are kneeling or seated in the wet grass, but they are all focused on the words like campers listening to a ghost story. Nor is it something you grow into or develop. It's not an emotion or a state of consciousness.
This can be a little trickier to understand until you realize that emotion and consciousness are the same thing. Or, more accurately, that emotions are states of consciousness. For example, half an hour ago I came down to the fire and started talking, and we all entered into a non-ordinary state of consciousness together, a sort of group euphoria. 15 or 20 minutes later, we had all returned to ordinary consciousness. That's an example of an altered state, not so different than being in a blinding rage or head over heels in love. You look back on something like that from your normal state, and it seems like you were a different person. Drugs, breath work, meditation, and other things can alter your state of consciousness. But self-realization, truth realization, isn't a state of consciousness. I look around at firelit faces and see frustration. They don't understand how it can be possible to get something that's not within their reach, to be something they can't become. You want to bring this whole thing down to the level where you can deal with it. But that's not possible. Truth isn't an idea or a concept. It's not in libraries or in the words of sages. It doesn't come in a flash of insight or a peak experience. It's not a feeling of bliss or ecstasy. It's not a concept to be understood or a feeling to be experienced. It's not in your heart or your mind. It's further. There's a charge in the air. The fire is dancing. The light rain is falling. But there's another element present as well. Everyone is on. Everyone is plugged into the words. Everyone is very present and focused. They sense that they may be on the verge of taking an important step forward. And if all goes well, they are. "So you're saying," says Randy, "you're saying that all religions and philosophies, see, this is where I can't wrap my mind around it. You're basically saying that all of man's spiritual teachings, like none of them are..." He stops, not even sure how to frame the question, but I know it's the question they all want to ask. To my ear, it's like two notes sounding together, in just such a way as to suggest an entire symphony. A pattern is beginning to reveal itself, and if I don't mess it up, it could develop into something pretty cool. "What am I saying?" I ask them. We're talking about lies, important lies, lies right at the heart of who and what we are. We're making serious accusations. We're committing heresy, because that's what heresy is, truth talk in the dream state. This is the fun stuff. "Spiritual awakening," I continue, "is about discovering what's true. Anything that's not about getting to the truth must be discarded. Truth isn't about knowing things. You already know too much. It's about unknowing. It's not about becoming true. It's about unbecoming false, so that all that's left is truth. If you want to become a priest or a lama or a rabbi or a theologian, then there's a lot to learn, tons and tons. But if you want to figure out what's true, then it's a whole different process. And the last thing you need is more knowledge." I'm going to use a lot of words to say what I want to say, but ultimately I'm only saying one thing. I pace back and forth before the fire, watching the light dance on their wet, attentive faces. The shortest and simplest way to address Randy's question is to say that all belief systems are just the stories we create in order to deal with the void. Ego abhors a vacuum. So everybody's scrambling to create the illusion of something where there's nothing. Belief systems are simply the devices we use to explain away the unthinkable horror of no self. This is unfolding nicely. I sometimes have a hard time gauging response to my words, because what's completely obvious to me might be completely unbelievable to someone listening. For some of those listening, I suppose, a blanket denouncement of all of man's religions and philosophies is humongous, and for some, it's old hat. For the purposes of tonight's lesson, it's just a stepping stone. Beliefs are candles that man uses to ward off the surrounding darkness. They are the charms we use to hold infinity at bay, to dispel the black cloud that hovers over every head. I don't want to move on without nailing this down. They don't have to believe me or agree with me, but I want them all to keep up. What I'm going to say tonight isn't really for them to understand tonight, but to take with them, and they won't be able to do that if they drop out at this point. What's going on here? I ask. What's the deal? Who am I? What am I? What lies beyond? What's the point? Those are big questions, and all the religions and spiritual traditions represent our attempts to answer them. Obviously, we can't answer correctly, but that's okay because we don't have to. We just have to answer adequately. We don't have to make the black cloud disappear. We just have to make it seem dark gray instead of black. Our explanations can be 99% unsatisfying, and that's good enough, because we don't need the black cloud gone. We just need it taken down a notch. I stop speaking and let the words hang. No one moves. No one speaks. I know they're silently re-evaluating their own beliefs from this perspective, but now's not the time. I proceed. Ever been depressed? I ask them. Really depressed? Like nothing means anything? Like there's no point to anything? I can see from their reactions that they all know what I'm talking about. And what's the worst thing about those dark moments? Where do they get their power? I wait a moment so they can think about it, so they'll recognize it when I say it. From their undeniability. Isn't that right? From the fact that there's no argument. When you're in that state, don't you know perfectly well that it's true? Heads nod, a few muffled assents. That's right. When you're in that space, you know it's not just a mood. You're seeing something you don't normally allow yourself to see. Your moments of blackest despair are really your most honest moments, your most lucid moments. That's when you're seeing without your protective lenses. That's when you pull back the curtain and see things as they are. A long silence. A heavy silence. Now, it's personal. They've all experienced those unfiltered moments. They've all known the feeling of utter futility. And most importantly, they remember that at the heart of that black despair is the knowledge that that's what's real. Everything is futile. Picture a hand sweeping away one of those beautiful Tibetan sand mandalas, I say quietly. I find my water bottle and take a drink. This still isn't quite where the whole thing is going, but it's definitely an important stop. I don't want to leave too soon or stay too long. After a few moments, I break the silence. Anybody know any good ghost stories? They laugh, and the pall that had been descending on them is somewhat dispelled. What about atheists? Asks Martin. Don't they have any belief system to shield them? In this context, there is no such thing as an atheist. If anything, we're all agnostics, and the only distinction between any two is one of degree. Everybody believes something, but only as much as they have to, enough to function. The cloud is still there, of course, hanging over every head, mocking every hope and dream. but thanks to our religions and philosophies, it's somehow not totally black, just a very dark gray, and we can go on about our lives. Is it vampires who can't enter until they're invited? I play with that idea for a while just to keep myself amused until the invitation arrives. Randy delivers it. So what you're saying is, it's all like, I mean, everything everybody believes, it's all just like lies, like bullshit? This isn't just any question. It's one of the biggies. This is a question that has to be asked and answered in the clearest possible terms, in the manner most likely to penetrate and stick. We've spent several minutes building up to it, preparing the way for it. But if I stopped now and gave a pop quiz, none of them would be quite sure what it was. That's the point. That's the reason that the big questions get the big production. This isn't a song we're singing or a mountain we're climbing. It's a dream we're unweaving. There's absolutely no chance that we're going to unravel a fantastically complex, multi-layered tapestry in a single evening. But the thread we're tugging on tonight can never be retightened. The fabric cannot be mended. The bell cannot be unrung. I let Randy's question hang in the air for a few moments, allowing the entire line of inquiry to establish itself in silence. All eyes are watching me expectantly. What's the wise fool gonna say? They wonder. That's part of the drama. They've heard it played the same way so many times that they have to wonder if I'm going to tap dance around the question with stock answers about respect for other people's beliefs and the validity of all viewpoints and how there's room for all of us. They expect politically correct evasions because that's what they've always heard. But this time, it's different. I'm not answering a question. I'm confirming a suspicion. Yes. I pause for dramatic effect. No belief is true. No belief is true. I just leave it hanging out there for a while, letting it imprint itself on these minds so they'll all be able to revisit it and confirm it for themselves later. This is a very big concept, but it's going to get bigger in a minute. The only movement is the dance of the flames and the falling spring rain. I speak only loudly enough to be heard. All beliefs, all concepts, all thoughts, yes, they're all false. All bullshit. Of course they are. Not just religions and spiritual teachings, but all philosophies, all ideas, all opinions. If you're going for the truth, you're not taking any of them with you. Nothing that says two, not one, survives. That's what I say. It rings true because it is true. It sounds a clear note that will resonate in these people's minds until its vibration has shaken their false belief structures into heaps of rubble. I mean, how can it not? I'm not telling them something I know. I'm showing them something they know. I take a break so everyone can do the math rather than just watch the teacher do it on the blackboard. As tempting as it may be for me to believe that I can wake people up by shaking or slapping them or just looking deeply enough into their eyes and coaxing them out, I know that the trance they're in can't be so easily broken. This sort of direct assault, though, is my version of whacking them with sticks like the Zen guys do. And now, because they still don't really see it. Okay, Brendan, I say. He looks startled to be singled out. What's the answer to your question? I I don't know. What question? The meaning of life. Didn't you ask me about the meaning of life? Well, yeah, I was just, joking. I didn't really expect, an answer or anything. Why not? I address my comments to the whole group. Why shouldn't we ask what the meaning of life is? Hell, shouldn't that be, like, the first thing we ask? Why should that, of all questions, be a joke? What are we? Livestock? How can we do anything until that most fundamental of all questions is answered? No one is leaping up to answer, least of all Brendan. So, Brendan, if you'll do the honors, what's the meaning of life? He looks like a deer caught in the headlights, but he thinks about what's been said here tonight, and he puts it together. There is none, he says. None what? There is no meaning. There is no meaning of life. Click. That's it. That's where this whole thing has been going. Saying that no belief is true is simply the inversion of this crisp, perfect statement. Life has no meaning. Thank you, Brendan. Very nicely done. And while that perfect statement may be the final destination of this evening's lesson, it's not the final destination of the process of self-realization. It's just the beginning, the starting point of inquiry. Like I told Julie at the boathouse, you have to start this journey by taking stock of what you know for sure. Wishful thinking and fear-based fairy tales don't play here. I'm not a priest, I continue to the silent group. I'm not a holy man or a guru. I have no teaching. I'm not representing any lineage or system. I'm not telling you the black cloud is okay. I'm telling you it's infinitely big and infinitely black. I'm not saying you can live with it. I'm saying that the black cloud is reality, so deal with it. And if it kills you, so the fuck what? I don't know how they're taking it, but for me, this is the best part. This way lies freedom, the only freedom. No one who plans on waking up has the luxury of pretending that the cloud is okay. It's not okay. It's not dark gray. It's reality, your reality. And if you want to get real, that's where you have to go. But, says Randy, no buts. Listen, 1/1000000th of 1% false is completely false. Everything in duality is false. False as in not true. Not true as in bullshit. There are no exceptions. Black and white. No shades of gray. Truth is one, is non-dual, is infinite, is one without other. Truth is dissolution, no self, unity. There's nothing to say about it, nothing to feel about it, nothing to know about it. You are true or you're a lie, as in ego-bound, as in dual, as in asleep. Silence. That felt good. The fabric is rent. Whatever stories, at whatever degree of belief these people use to shield themselves from reality, have just been structurally destabilized. The stories may survive for weeks, or months, or years, but their demise is now assured, and the time will come when each of these people gets what they came here for, a direct confrontation with reality. Or not. Never bet against Maya. Truth is infinitely simple. Delusion is infinitely complex. There's no overestimating our ability to avoid making eye contact with the obvious. Maybe some of them will now scramble deeper into their stories. But for those who are here to hear, the leveling note has been sounded. Once again, Randy asks the question they all want the answer to. So all beliefs are bullshit, as opposed to, like, what? As opposed to facing facts. As opposed to saying, fuck it, I'm going to see for myself. As opposed to declaring truth or bust, and meaning exactly that, truth at all costs, truth regardless of consequence, truth at any price. Whew. I slump into my chair and let everyone sit quietly with their thoughts while I sit with mine. That was a tricky thing to try to convey. Did I say it well? Did I leave out anything important? I replay it in my head and am satisfied that I made the best of a difficult but critical piece of communication. It's a few minutes before anyone even moves around, and I think I started to doze off. Eventually, the dialogue picks up again. Well, is it true that all religions are built upon the same foundation? One of them, Marla, asks. That they all contain the same truth? That's a good cooling-off question. The intense part is over, and now I can use this as a ramp to slide us all back down into a more mellow, dare I say, groove. Oh, gosh, yeah, maybe, I suppose, if you really want to stretch a point. But not in any sense it would be of a practical value to someone who is trying to wake themselves up. That's the sort of qualification I'd make if I wanted to appear open and accepting, but I would certainly never try to help anyone awaken by suggesting that they make a study of world religions or spiritual teachings. I mean, I can pick up a Bible, or the Koran, or the Talmud, or the Upanishads, or the Dhammapada, or any of the noteworthy spiritual texts, and I, me, Jed, can decipher them within the context of truth. I can see what they say that's of possible value. I can see what was probably valuable before Sleeping Minds rewrote it. And I can see what's just nonsense. In short, I can read the great spiritual teachings of the world from the perspective of one who has made the journey and judge them based on their effectiveness as maps for others making the journey. Now, to answer your question in a way that might be of some value to you, I would say, yeah, okay, you could say that all the major religions and great spiritual teachings have the same truth at their core. But realistically, that does not make them useful to someone who is seeking enlightenment, because the useful stuff is tangled up with too much useless stuff. They say that a million monkeys banging on a million typewriters will eventually produce the complete works of Shakespeare. But I don't want to be the guy who has to read through it all. That gets a laugh. The mood is loosening up a bit. Mad, iconoclastic, nihilistic, heretic guy is gone, and funny, mellow wisdom guy is back. You're looking for an exact map. And these great texts are thick bundles of pages covered in scribble. Yes, some of the lines in all that scribble are actually somewhat accurate, as far as they may go. But you're not going to have any way of knowing which ones are right until you've made the journey yourself. By which time, of course, you'll no longer need the map. Even Martin, with his strong ties to Vedic scripture, seems attentive and thoughtful. You've all heard the saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Well, that means a lot more than just the mysterious arrival of gurus in a timely manner. It means that the knowledge you need will appear when you're ready for it. The ability to open the next door is never denied, but the ability to open the door after the next is never granted. In this sense, you'll have many, many teachers. In this sense, a passage from the Bible might be exactly the right thing at exactly the right time. But that doesn't mean the entire Bible is the right thing all the time. Even the books and teachings I like the most, I consider 90% useless. I look around at the faces and see a spectrum of comprehension ranging from near empty to near full. That's to be expected. It's all about unlocking the next door, I continue, and having 10,000 keys doesn't mean a thing if none of them opens the door you're standing in front of. Teacher is just a word for the key you need to open the next door. After you are enlightened, you can revisit these great books and the great teachings to your heart's content, and then they'll no longer be mysterious or impenetrable to you, but they'll still be of no use to you, because you'll already be enlightened. So it would really only be a recreational pursuit. "Then why do you have all those books in the house?" asks Rita. Good question. "Because," I'm tempted to say, "a dozen new ones mysteriously appear every day." Most of the books inside are of no value to someone trying to wake up. I can't think of one that I'd hand to a student and say, "Here, this is what you need to know." Worse by far are those that appear the best, like writings on Zen and Advaita. If I were to only allow useful books in the house, there'd probably only be a few dozen. I expect the next question to flow straight from my last statement, but they surprise me. Instead of asking which books I'd hang on to, Mary speaks up. "Then why don't you write one?" she asks. "A book about you and Sonia and the house and all your students." Everyone bursts into applause and hooting to express their approval of the idea. Then, when they settle down, I reply. "It's too far out," I say. "No one would ever believe such a thing could happen in Iowa. Hell, I hardly believe it myself." Everybody laughs. Chapter 23. Big Hitter, the Lama. So I jump ship in Hong Kong and make my way over to Tibet, and I get on as a looper at a course over in the Himalayas. A looper, you know, a caddy. A looper, a jock. So I tell them I'm a pro-jock, and who do you think they give me? The Dalai Lama himself, 12th son of the Lama. The flowing robes, the grace, bald, striking. So I'm on the first tee with him. I give him the driver. He hauls off and whacks one, a big hitter, the Lama, long, into a 10,000-foot crevice, right at the base of this glacier. So we finish the 18th, and he's gonna stiff me. And I say, "Hey, Lama, hey, how about a little something? You know, for the effort, you know?" And he says, "Oh, there won't be any money, but when you die, on your deathbed, you will receive total consciousness." So I got that going for me, which is nice. Bill Murray, Caddyshack. Chapter 24. I've done what I came to do. Who calls my poems poems? My poems are not poems. Knowing my poems are not poems, together we can begin to speak of poems. Ryokan. That last half hour was unexpected. Delivering the whole black cloud talk was not premeditated, but, as I say, I don't really plan these things. I just follow the flow and play my part and enjoy the ride. "You talk a lot about the light of intellect and the power of discrimination," one of the guys asks out of the blue, as if he's been saving it up. "Is your third eye open?" That's a sign that the fun stuff is over and that goofy, metaphysical stuff is starting. Nothing to do but make the best of it. Yeah, I reply reluctantly. Well, if you're asking just from curiosity about me, the answer is I don't know. I get a bit confused when the discussion turns to metaphysics. If you're asking because you want to know if mystical powers are necessary to achieve enlightenment, then the answer is no. No superpowers required. If you're asking whether or not you get mystical powers as, like, a bonus when you become enlightened, then the answer isn't so clear. I don't see auras or know the future or anything like that. I suppose I could go out and develop some mystical skills, but I wouldn't know what to do with them. I have no such desire. On the other hand, I have heightened abilities, might be a good way to put it, that most of you haven't gotten around to developing or recognizing in yourself yet. These abilities are not really related to enlightenment directly, though. At least they don't hinge upon it. Nor it on they. I'm talking about the ability to manifest desires, for one, to shape your personal reality. Another might be the ability to view life not in detail, but in broad patterns, as if from a greater altitude, and to flow through it from that more elevated perspective. That's why I get hesitant when asked about my third eye and all that. Someone who doesn't have the knowledge to shape his own personal reality might consider it a power or as something mystical, whereas to me it's just something I know how to do. I started doing it for very practical purposes before awakening, and I never thought of it as anything but the way things really work. There's no great mystery to it. It's only magic when you don't know how it works. Once you know, you know. I don't think the guy who adjusts the timing on my car is a mystically empowered dude. He just knows how to do something. I don't. I smile at the rapt faces dancing in the firelight. They're listening. Strange as it may sound, I sometimes forget that people are actually listening. I guess I sometimes get the feeling that I'm just singing my song because it amuses me to do so. I forget that it actually amuses others, too. Which two or three dozen? Mary asks, and it takes me a moment to realize that she's jumping back to my statement about which books would remain if I were more discriminating about the library. Oh, I'd want to be a little careful answering that, I say. The reason for the books I'd choose wouldn't be that they are particularly enlightened or enlightening books, or even specifically on the subject of enlightenment. My choices would be based on what I feel is useful knowledge on the path to enlightenment, which is very different from enlightenment itself. In this light, I'd have a bunch of books and maybe some movies, too, because they're often a common experience we share and can provide an interesting framework for highlighting certain issues. Like what? She asks. I think about some of the movies I've seen in the last few years that most everybody would be familiar with. Well, The Matrix would be a good example of a movie I could get a lot of use out of. Total Recall, The 13th Floor, Blade Runner. Those are all good looks at the flimsy and even arbitrary nature of what we consider reality. Joe versus the Volcano is another one I'd use, because of the parable-like view it takes of the death-rebirth process. There are probably a few dozen more if I thought about it. The Peter Brook version of the Mahabharata, certainly. All the Mornings of the World would be a nice look at the teacher-student relationship. What Dreams May Come to demonstrate the relationship between thoughts and reality. Plenty of others, for different reasons. Harvey, just because. I pause to consider and decide I'd better stick with general recommendations not too open to misinterpretation. I don't want to mention any books that would require me to include a lengthy disqualifier. As for books, besides the ones that you would all guess, various versions and translations of the Bhagavad Gita and the Tao Te Ching, there'd be a version of the Mahabharata accessible to Westerners. The Three Pillars of Zen by Roshi Philip Kaplow, Stranger in a Strange Land by Heinlein, The Razor's Edge by Mom, Walden, Leaves of Grass, Emerson's Essays, Anything by Stan Grof, Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell, Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot, and so forth, all good for different reasons. There would also be a small collection of channeled material, some spiritual novels with a theme of rebirth. Almost everyone reacts at the same time to the mention of channeled material. The general response seems to be a mixture of surprise and disbelief. I find channeled material very useful and interesting, not just for teaching, but for my own understanding of the phenomenal world in which, as you can see, I exist just like anyone else. If you want me to be specific, I'd say I'd like Michael for understanding ego and personality structure. When it comes to personal reality, I like Seth. If I have questions about flow and manifestation and desire, then I read Abraham. I might be forgetting something, but those are the main ones I like. A Course in Miracles certainly has its moments. So those channeled entities were instrumental in your own... Oh, no, 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 not really. I wave a hand dismissively. It's more like combined. They make up my user's manual for being a human on Earth. Being human, 101. This is why I want to be careful about this discussion. I like the books I mentioned, but I don't really look at them that often, usually just when I have a specific question. So what do you read for amusement? Asks Mary. Besides Harlequin romances? I like Osho, the enlightened guy, formerly known as the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. Some surprise registers throughout the group about this, which is quite understandable. If one equates enlightenment with sainthood, then Osho might come off as a more of an anti-saint, especially if one has only heard the stories of murder plots and free love and power grabs and tax evasion and the 90 Rolls Royces. I like his teaching style. I like his take on Zen. I am in awe of his mind. And novels. I read a lot of fiction. I can see from their reaction that I need to say more. All right, you got me. I spend a lot of time just killing time. I play video games, read books, watch movies. I'd say I probably blow several hours a day that way. But I don't see it as a waste, because I don't have anything better to spend my time on. I couldn't put it to better use, because I'm not trying to become something or accomplish anything. I have no dissatisfaction to drive me, no ambition to draw me. I've done what I came to do. I'm just killing time till time kills me. This seems to have a quieting effect on the group. I suppose they hadn't considered the possibility that enlightenment was the end of a lot of things we don't normally think of as having ends. Finally, Mary breaks the spell by returning us to the discussion of books. "What if you were stranded on a desert island?" she asks, "and could only have one book?" "Easy," I reply. "Calvin and Hobbes." Everyone laughs. I close my eyes and lean my head back, and everyone takes that as a signal to give me some peace. They talk among themselves, but I'm not listening to them. I'm listening to everything and nothing, and feeling the light rain on my face and breathing the fresh night air, bringing it all the way down so it cleanses me and carries away the heaviness that builds up after long periods in character. I'm not tired or ending the evening. I just want to not hear my own voice for a while. I want to pay attention to the rain and to the breeze. I want to let one topic fade out so that a new and fresher one might come along. Chapter 25. The Uncherished Sword. This sword is an ugly, meaty tool. Not one for pageants and ceremonies. Not one for a collector's wall. Not one to show the grandkids. It has no scabbard, no tassel.
No craftsman has left his mark. The handle is cracked and dry. The metal has lost its shine. Dull and dirty, pitted with age, dried blood caked at the hilt. Once it held a razor's edge and shone with the light of the sun. But now it sits unused, forgotten. When beheading time comes, I know right where it is. But beheading time is over. Why read about another's sword? It's your head that's still attached. Jed McKenna. End of Disc 5.